Well, thank you, Lee, for that introduction. It's so nice to see you all on this lovely Saturday morning. I know how precious these days are, and especially since we've had such cold weather in the last month or so, and I'm very grateful to you indeed for coming out this morning. I'm going to talk for the first session on the Ten Commandments, then move to the Lord's Prayer in the second session, and then look at the Apostles' Creed in the third session. Lee mentioned that I speak different languages. This is true, but I think the only thing I need to warn you about this morning is that I sometimes speak a rather old-fashioned form of English, because it comes more naturally to me. So if I say things like thee and thou, please don't pretend you don't understand. With my American students, I give them a cultural immersion class every year if they're coming to the UK, and one of the things I tell them is that you'll find in Britain people speak a more traditional form of English than that what they're used to. And they say, what do you mean? I say, well, you may hear people using words like please and thank you, which you've only ever heard from your grandparents. But anyhow, so if I lapse into sort of pre-modern English, just excuse me for that, and I'm sure it won't be beyond your ability to understand. I'm combining this morning this study of the Ten Commandments, the Lord's Prayer, and the Apostles' Creed under an overall rubric, one might say, of theology. I was going to say systematic theology, but there are some people who turn the volume down when they hear that word. I don't mean to do it like that, but the point I want to make is that the Bible is a coherent message from God, that it is consistent from beginning to end, that the teaching which God gave in the Old Testament ties in with the teaching given in the New Testament, which in turn ties in with the message which we today in the church preach. There are many ways in which this could be demonstrated, but I think one very helpful way is to look at these three key texts, which of course are well known, and they're well known for a reason, because it seems to me that they contain, if you like, the substance of the gospel message. And I want to begin looking at this with the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments are in many ways the heart, the core of the Old Testament message. What is the Old Testament all about? Basically, the Old Testament is about what we call the covenant. That is to say, God's plan for his people. That God chose for himself a people in Abraham, in Isaac, and in Jacob, and he formed that people over many hundreds of years, preparing them for the coming of Christ. That Jesus, of course, came into the world, the Son of God came into the world as a member of that nation, as one of that people, that he lived according to the law which had been given to that people, and in his death and resurrection fulfilled the purpose for which that law had originally been given. Now, it's easy for Christians to say that the law of the Old Testament is the past. This was fine for them, perhaps, back then, but it's no longer of any relevance to us. And like many things, of course, there is a truth in this. We are no longer under the law of the Old Testament. This is made very clear by the Apostle Paul, and indeed by the other writers of the New Testament as well. And we wouldn't want to go back. Christianity is not simply a revised form of Judaism, if you like. I mean, it's a different thing altogether. However, having said that, We also believe that the law of God and the covenant made with Abraham, given in the Old Testament, is our heritage as Christians. It is where we come from. It is the tree out of which we have grown, and this is also made very clear in the New Testament, that Jesus came to fulfill the law. He came to graft the Gentiles, that is you and me, non-Jewish people, into the covenant made with Abraham. Abraham is the father of our faith, and so what was given to them was also intended for us, for our learning. And what we see when we read the Old Testament is we see the principles laid down, the principles of the covenant, the way God wants his people to live, the way God wants you to live and me to live, and which has been made possible in the coming of Christ, in his death, in his resurrection, and of course in his sending of the Holy Spirit. And what we see, the circumstances in which the Ten Commandments were given, were the circumstances of the Exodus. The people who had been in Egypt for 400 years leave Egypt. They go into the desert, and it is when they get into the desert, of course, that Moses goes up the mountain, and up the mountain he receives the commandments from God. And it's at that moment, if you like, that when the law is given to Israel, that the nation, as we understand it, is formed. It's given its basis, the basis on which it would continue to exist until the time of Jesus. And as time went on, of course, people began to see that this was a picture. This was a picture of what God was going to do in a spiritual sense with his people, that the time of slavery in Egypt was to be compared with the slavery which we have, the spiritual slavery to sin, to Satan, to the old life. And the Exodus, the leaving of the slavery in Egypt is comparable in a way to the deliverance from sin. And the life, of course, the generation spent in the desert in preparation for crossing into the promised land, which in spiritual terms is entering into the inheritance which we have and which is stored up for us in heaven. And so this picture, as it were, is used as a kind of allegory, if you like, later on, of the spiritual life, of the Christian life. And we need to at least be aware of that to understand where the commandments fit, if you like, in the overall pattern of our life, that these are not commandments meant for unbelievers. This is not something that can be imposed, if you like, on people who are in slavery to sin. I mean, the Ten Commandments were not given to the people of Israel in the land of Egypt in those circumstances, but as part of their freedom, when they were set free to live in the way that God wanted them to live, when they were given a kind of renewal of the covenant in the desert and prepared for what was to come. It is at that point that this structure is given to them. And of course, the whole point of it was that people who had been set free by God were set free to live in the way that God intended them to live. And this is again something which is very strongly stressed in the New Testament. It's not by accident that when Jesus speaks of the commandments, when he takes thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, and so on, and he expounds the meaning of these things, is that he takes what appears on the surface to be, very straightforward teaching, and then opens it up in a way that people hadn't previously understood, and brings it home to each and every one of his hearers. I mean, thou shalt not kill is a very good example of this. If we say it like that, and we think of it in a sort of legal terms, of course, probably there isn't anybody in this room, I imagine, who has killed anyone. And you can sort of look at that and say, thou shalt not kill, and tick it off and say, all right, haven't done that, and on to the next one. And this is, of course, what people did. in the time of Jesus. I mean, the Pharisees and so on knew that they hadn't broken that commandment. Very few people had. And so they didn't really think there was much to it other than that. I mean, of course, some people would fall foul of it, but not them. And so Jesus had to turn and look at them and say, if you have had in your heart any evil thought against another person, you have killed that person already. And so you see what Jesus is doing with the Ten Commandments is he's taking something which at one level applies to only a very small number of people and interpreting it in a way which shows that when you internalize the commandment, when you see that, you know, it's not just a question of what you do physically, it's what you think in your mind, spiritually, and so on, then, of course, something which is a very unusual application, you might say rare application, suddenly becomes something of universal relevance, because which one of us has not at some time had that kind of feeling in our heart? And if you claim to me that, say to me that you have never had this feeling, I ask you, do you drive? Because if you drive, I guarantee you've had this feeling a lot. It's amazing how stupid other people are, aren't they? And this is the freedom, you see, the freedom to live for God in this way. And this is what the commandments are meant to say. And, of course, they are meant also to be a sign of reconciliation between the Creator and His creatures. Because we are, before anything else, creatures who are made in the image and likeness of God. And because we are made in the image and likeness of God, we are meant to live in a way which reflects that glory. And it's the fact that we don't that is the problem. Because the image and likeness of God in us, you see, has been betrayed, not, of course, by God, but by us. That we have denied our creation. We have denied the way that we are by our sin, by rebelling against God. And I point out to you that it's only creatures who are created in the image and likeness of God who can sin. Dogs and cats and so on do not sin. They may behave badly, but that's not the same thing. All right, and we need to remember this. You see that the whole concept of sin and responsibility and so on is something which is tied to our creation in the image and likeness of God, and the Ten Commandments are meant to reflect this. Now, if you read through the commandments and see how they're structured, you see that they follow a specific pattern. The first three of them cover what a theologian would call the doctrine of God. In other words, you're talking here about who God is. And of course, the first commandment makes it very plain that there is only one God, and this one God is to be worshipped above everything and everyone else. Now, we benefit here from several thousand years of monotheistic tradition. And I think we must recognize this. If, for example, you take a survey today and walk down the street here and say, just buttonhole people in the street and say, do you believe in God? Virtually everybody you speak to, whether they believe in God or not, will understand that what you are asking is, do you believe in the God who is revealed in the Bible? You see, because the word God in our culture and our society tends to mean that. And so it's hard for us to picture a society which, of course, the society which existed in the time of Moses and indeed in the time of Jesus, where you could not have asked that question without serious ambiguity. You could have asked Jews that question, of course, in the time of Jesus, but not other people. Because we say, do you believe in God? They say, well, which God are you talking about? You know, that concept of monotheism was not accepted. In a sort of standard way. And we forget this. So the first commandment is one which focuses our attention on the one God who has delivered us, you see, who delivered his people from the bondage of Egypt, from the slavery of sin. He is someone who has acted in our lives, and that is why we recognize him, because he has revealed himself to us in that way. It is not just a philosophical conclusion that people have come to, by figuring, trying to work out, well, where, you know, how does it all hang together? I mean, that is also true, but that's not how we come to know God. We come to know God because he is our deliverer, and that is made very clear in the first commandment. Then, of course, we are reminded in the second commandment that not to make any graven image. You cannot make any image of God. Why not? Because there is nothing in the creation which can compare to the Creator. The Creator is fundamentally different in his being from anything that there is in the created order. Now, why is this important? It's vitally important because if the Creator could be reduced to an element of his creation, then he would not be sovereign. You see, it is the sovereignty of God, the power of God, that God is over and above the creation which he has made. Now, this does not mean, that God does not interact with his creation. Some of you may know this, of course, from personal experience. If you build things, my favorite image in this respect is toy railways. You know, some people, they put together toy railways. They buy them for their children and then play with them themselves. You know how it is. And, put these things together. And you make it all work and it kind of runs and so on. But you, of course, who are the fat controller, are sort of sitting there on top and you survey the whole thing. I mean, you are involved. There's an interaction between the Creator and the thing which is created. So we mustn't fall into the trap of people who say, oh, if you have a Creator God who's up there over and above us, he's a distant God, he has nothing to do with us and so on. This does not follow. This is not what we are saying. We are saying that God is over and above us so that he can be free to be in and with us. Because what we have to remember is that if we objectify God, if we say that this is God, and sort of stick him over there and worship him, what we're doing in effect is limiting God. You see, we are tying God down, which may appear to be advantageous, but is in fact taking away from his power, from his sovereignty, from his ability to be with us everywhere, all the time, and in every way. And so not to make an image of God is actually fundamental to us, you see, because to do so is to limit him. And then, of course, the third commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. What does this mean? Again, we have to think a little bit. Today, names have lost their meaning. You see, it doesn't really matter what we are called. You may not know what your name means. And even if you do, you may not quite understand what it's got to do with you. You know, why should you be called whatever it is you're called? I mean, does it reflect your character in some way? Perhaps not, you know, and we don't think in this way today. But of course, if you read the Bible, you don't have to go very far, you soon discover that names are highly significant. People were given names. People had their names changed when God reached into their lives and appointed them for some particular purpose. You see, Peter, for example, you know, Simon, who suddenly called Peter the rock, because it's on this rock that Jesus was going to build his church, and he called him Peter for that reason. You see, so there's a definite purpose which we have to understand. And to people who are used to thinking in this way, of course, the name of God has a very specific meaning. And in the Bible, when you look through the scriptures, the name of God refers to his power, his sovereignty. You don't play around with the name of God, because the name of God is something very powerful. And in fact, Jewish people, of course, as you may know, take this to the point where the name of God revealed to Moses at the burning bush in Exodus 3 is something that they never pronounce. You know, the four letters which represent the name of God, which we would transcribe as YHWH, and sometimes pronounce as Yahweh, sort of inventing a pronunciation, no Jewish person would ever say this. You see, and of course, over the years, they put a substitute word in there, and very often the word that they substituted was Adonai, meaning my Lord. And when they read Yahweh, they said Adonai instead. And you may not realize this, but if you take the consonants of Yahweh and the vowel sounds of Adonai and put them together, what you end up with is Yahowah, out of which we get Jehovah. You see, so Jehovah is an artificial construct, really, out of these two. I'm just saying this so the next time they come knocking on your door, you can tell them that. You know, Jehovah's Witness is an artificial thing from the start in this way. And, of course, the writers of the New Testament followed this tradition and used the word Lord. So in the New Testament puts Lord, you know, the Lord said to so-and-so, when the Old Testament that they're quoting actually says Yahweh, but they won't use this word. You see, or translate it, because the name of God was something so precious and so powerful to them. And so we need to remember this. We need to remember this not in this kind of superstitious and superficial way, but you cannot take God for granted. You cannot play with God. You must remember that in dealing with God, you are dealing with your Creator. And in dealing with your Creator, you are dealing with the one who has the power of life and death over you. And we need to recapture this. You see, recapture this sense that in the presence of God, we are on holy ground. Because we've lost this in our society. You see, we have a familiarity, if you like, with God, which is wholly inappropriate for who he is. Now, we are, of course, called into a relationship with God. We are called into a friendship with God. But this friendship, this relationship, is a friendship and a relationship with our Creator. Not with someone who is our equal, but with someone who is our Maker. And we need the commandments remind us of this. Do not take God's name in vain. Don't play around with him. Remember who he is, because everything else comes from that. The second thing, of course, moving on, is what God has made. The Creator has made his creation. And the fourth commandment is a reminder of this. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth. You see, it is a direct reference to the creation. And what is the importance of this? First of all, the first thing is the creation is complete. The creation is what God intended it to be. Now, here I think is an issue that we have to face in the modern world, because in the modern world there are people who say that the world we have around us is not the world that is meant to be. You see, and we can, of course, with technology and so on, change it. We can alter it. Now, this is a very delicate and difficult subject because, of course, on the one hand, there is a certain sense in which this is legitimate. in healing diseases and so on, putting right things that have gone wrong and what have you. In other words, restoring the natural order to what it should be, to the way in which God intended it to be. That is one thing. It is another thing, of course, when we start playing around and creating things which God did not intend to be, which were not part of the created order at the beginning. I don't like to sort of bring up particular issues here, but I think I have to give you some examples. One of the most obvious examples, concerns human sexuality. This is a complicated area, I know, but if you look at the creation, you see that what God created was male and female, and he created them for each other. And yet we live in a day and age when this is being forgotten and denied. Why should it be like this? You see, why should you have one man and one woman coming together to create a family? I mean, why can't you have two men or two women? And if you need a family, you can find a donor somewhere or something like this. You see, find some artificial means to overcome this unfortunate natural barrier. Now, I'm caricaturing slightly, I know, but this is an area, you see, where the issue at stake fundamentally is one of creation. What is meant to be? What did God intend from the start? And we need to see this, we need to understand this, and we need to remember that one of the things which we learn from the fourth commandment is that the Lord created the world in 6 days. We see this in the Genesis account. It is complete, and he saw it, and it was very good, what he had made. That is it. You see, we don't have to add to the creation. We don't have to change it in some way, because what God has given us is good in itself. The second thing, of course, here is that the creation is a universe. Now, I know this sounds obvious to you, but it's not necessarily obvious. The word universe, if you stop and think about it, means is related to unity, oneness. You see that there is a coherence there. There have been people over the years, and there are still people today, who deny this. You see, who say, well, there is no principle of unity, of underlying unity. I mean, where does this idea come from? However you express it, whether you express it in some form of dualism, you know, good versus evil, a sort of equal powers, or whatever, I mean, however you interpret this, if you deny the unity of the creation, you are denying the sovereignty of the Creator God. And so we have to say that our belief in God, the Creator, the Sovereign Lord, is also a belief that things hang together, so that if you touch one thing, it will affect others. You can't isolate one aspect of the creation from the rest. And of course, we're discovering this, aren't we? Just the other day, of course, I've been in the States all last week, as you know, and one thing, Americans love to eat. Have you noticed that? They're all vastly overweight. Anyhow, they're talking about the food crisis, you see, this week, and it turns out that a lot of the food crisis has come from these biofuels that have, become popular in the last little while. And they're saying, you try to solve one problem, and you end up creating another, as if this was a new discovery. They didn't realize this was going to happen. But we need to appreciate this and be aware of this, because we live in a world where people, for various reasons, propose things, they want things, and they don't see the knock-on effects, in the world as a whole. So the creation is a universe. And then, of course, it must be respected for what it is. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. The Lord rested on the Sabbath day. There is a respect that we have to have for the work which has been completed. And we need to recover, I think, that sense. Well, moving on from creation, we come to the doctrine of man, the human race. Honor thy father and mother, the fifth commandment, is a reminder of where we have come from. Human beings have many different relationships through life, and most of these relationships are relationships which either come to us involuntarily, like we end up with brothers and sisters that we haven't asked for, or they are relationships which we have chosen, a spouse or children and so on. But the one relationship, or the two relationships, which we all have from day one and we can't do anything about, are father and mother. These are the most permanent, fundamental, and basic relationships that we have. And of course, the Bible reminds us of this. We make fun of it, I think, rather too readily, all those genealogies that you read in the Old Testament. But the genealogies are actually very important because they remind us, you see, of where we have come from as a race, that we are connected. They're a way of telling us this, you see, connected not only with each other in the human race, but, of course, with the origins of the human race, with Adam and Eve. This is a very fundamental thing, and we are called to honor this thing, the unity of the human race. We are all fundamentally one because we all derive from the same parents, from Adam and Eve. And we need to understand this because the Bible promises us that if we respect this, if we appreciate this, if we understand that we belong together as one, you know, big human family, if we like, that we are brothers and sisters in creation, this is the secret of self-preservation. This is how we will live, because we will live because we will respect and we will honor one another. We will respect where we came from, we will honor this, and we will seek to maintain it. And this is a source of strength and a source of life. And we need to remember that all the time. Of course, solidarity with Adam and Eve in creation is also solidarity with Adam and Eve in sin. But this is, although this is a terrible thing, and I'm not trying to exalt sin in any way, it's also a comforting thing because it's another way in which the human race is united. And again, we need to remember this because the gospel is for everybody. You cannot say, well, just because someone is, say, Chinese, we don't have to preach the gospel to them because they don't need it. That's a different culture. Or they're Jewish, you know, mustn't preach the gospel to Jews because they have their own way of salvation. Occasionally hear people saying this kind of thing. That the gospel is all right if that's the culture you were brought up in and so on. But we mustn't go and evangelize other people, other nations or other races or whatever, because they're different from us. And we need to say, no, they're not. I mean, there are differences, yes, but fundamentally at the root, we are one and the same because we are united in Adam and Eve, both for good and for bad. And that the message of the gospel is that the bad can be put right by Jesus. Jesus came to die for the human race, not just for Jewish people, not just for men, not just for, his friends or whatever. He came to die for the human race. And so no human being is excluded a priori from the start from the message of salvation. We are called to preach to all. It doesn't mean that all are saved. It doesn't even mean that all were meant to be saved. But there's nobody who is excluded, on the grounds of race or culture or sex or anything like that from hearing the word. So that is a very important point. Then we come to the commandments 6 to 8, the commandment about murder, adultery, and theft. And I thought about this, so why do they focus on these three things above all else? And it occurred to me as I thought through that there is a logic here. That first of all, murder, thou shalt not kill, is violence against another person. You are actually extinguishing that person's existence. So this is very fundamental. Adultery is perhaps not quite as basic as that. in the sense that you are not eliminating the other person, but you are violating them in a different way. You are violating relationships with other people, and in some respects that can be worse. It can be harder to live with a broken relationship than with a dead one. You know, because you can at least say, well, that's nothing we can do about that. That's finished. But break a relationship, destroy a trust, and then try to live with it. Try to put that back together. Very, very difficult. And so this commandment is a very fundamental one. You know, that to respect your relationships with other people and maintain the relationship, the correct relationship, don't transgress the relationship which you are meant to have, because if you do, you may find yourself in just as much trouble as you would find yourself if you actually killed that person. And then, of course, theft, thou shalt not steal, is taking what belongs to other people. This is another form of violence against them. Perhaps in a way less serious than the other two in one sense, but nevertheless with consequences which can be just as dramatic and of course are just as wrong, that we are not to do those things. And then finally, what I've called the doctrine of sanctification, how it is that we are to relate to other people, how it is that we are to live. And there are two commandments here. First of all, the commandment not to bear false witness, and secondly, the commandment not to covet. And it seems to me that they fit logically in this order. Because to bear false witness against another person is, of course, a way of disrespecting them, if there is such a word, showing them disrespect, that almost in a sense reducing them to the point where their interests, their integrity and so on no longer matters. You see, you are in a sense trying to destroy the other person. And why would you do this? Well, of course, one of the reasons is to take advantage of them, to covet what they have, you see, and to reach out to this. And it's interesting that in the New Testament, coveting is connected with idolatry, you see, the worship of things, of creatures rather than the Creator, because people have this greed, this sense of greed, if you can eliminate other people, if you can diminish other people, then of course you have a reason to reach out and take what belongs to them. Your whole attitude to them and to what they have will be different. Why is this a matter of sanctification? I think it is a matter of sanctification because in learning not to bear false witness to other people, in learning not to covet what they have, we are really learning who we are in relation to God. And it seems to me that this is the essence of sanctification, of what it means to be holy. Holiness is not a matter of doing things or not doing things. It is primarily a matter of understanding who we are in the sight of God. And of course, if we realize that we are not free to pass judgment on others, we are not free to bear false witness against our neighbor. You see, we must respect. We don't have the power to do this. This is a recognition of our own limitation, of our own dependence on God, because it is God who will judge. You see, it is God who will decide. It is He who determines what is right and what is wrong, not us. You see, we don't set up judgment against others. We rely on His judgment. Coveting, the world in a sense belongs to us because we are given it as creatures, but we need to use it in the right way. And of course, the way in which we use the things that have been given to us demonstrates the nature of our relationship with God. If I am in the right relationship with God, if I fear God in my life, this will show itself in the way I live, in the way I use my possessions, and in the way in which I am content to use what has been given to me, and I'm not greedy and covetous and desirous of what has been given to other people. I respect them and respect what they have, and recognize that I am part of a wider family, if you like, a wider framework. And we see this in the New Testament, in the life of the church, that one of the problems that people had in the early church was that they were covetous. Not covetous, perhaps, of other people's money, but covetous of their spiritual gifts. And the Apostle Paul had to say, look, you know, one is given this thing, one is given another thing. The eye cannot say to the ear, I have no need of you, you know, because everything you can do, I can do better. Not this. Turning away from covetousness is turning to the need for fellowship, the need for integration into a wider family, and that is part of the call to holiness that we have, to recognize that we belong to one another, that we need one another. Now, of course, I've got to stop now, but in the Old Testament, these things are laid down in the form of law. And as I've already pointed out, Jesus opened up that law and showed that underneath those prescriptions there were spiritual principles which were easy to ignore. You see, it was easy to fall back on an external observance of the law and not see the underlying principles. And this was a mistake. This was something the people were not to do. But having said that, those who are enlightened by the Spirit of God, those who know the power of Christ in their lives, can look back on these commandments, can look back on this law and see how it falls into place, how it fits. And that's what I've tried to say this morning in the time that's available to me. One of my greater faults, I hasten to add, is that I talk a lot. And I do apologize for that. It's a very bad habit. I promise you that I will at least try in the next period we have together to allow for a few questions. But I've run out of time for that. And I'm told that if there's one thing we must not do, it is cut short the coffee time. And so we'll have a little break now and come back at 11:15? Yes. 10 past 11 and carry on, and I'll do my best to shut up sooner. Thank you. Anybody got anything there? Yes, Kerry. I didn't mention keeping Sunday special when talking about the Sabbath rest. And why did I not do this? Well, I think there's several reasons. One, of course, is that Sunday is not the Sabbath. As you know, this is the Sabbath. And if we were following the commandments strictly, we wouldn't be here. Because you wouldn't have traveled here on the Sabbath day. That would have been breaking the Sabbath. I mean, hearing me talk is fine, but you couldn't have come the way you did. And so on, and we see this. So, this is a little bit facetious, because of course strict Jewish people are like this. I mean, they observe the Sabbath in a very strict way. I think we have to say here that the principle of Sabbath rest and keeping Sunday special are overlapping things, but they're not the same. We keep Sunday special because Sunday is the day of worship, the day of resurrection, of Jesus Christ, and we remember this, and it is the day that we choose to worship. But we don't do this in a kind of fixed and superstitious way. I mean, I don't have to worship on a Sunday as opposed to a Monday, say. you know. I mean, we do this because we have to meet sometime, and it's something like this. But it's not written in the law of God that it must be like this in quite the same way. There is, of course, a creation principle of rest, that one day in seven, you know, you should rest. Yes, that's another thing. But I think we have to say here that when we fight to keep Sunday special, what we are fighting for are two things. One is the principle of rest as a society, you know, that not just as individuals, that it is important that we should have social rest. And, of course, fighting for the freedom of worship. Because if you're working on Sunday, I mean, you may not be free to worship together with others. I mean, there is an advantage in doing that. But I don't think we should push this to the point, of saying that it's part of the immutable law of God that we must do this on this day in this way. That I think it's not quite as much as that. I'm sticking myself out on, I'm going out on a limb here, I know, because I know some people feel very strongly about this. And I mean, I do too in a way, you know, I mean, I think it is important. But we have to be careful of what our scriptural basis for it is. Yes, in Hebrews 4, heaven, yeah, the Sabbath rest of the people of God is the rest in heaven. Yes, definitely. And there is that dimension, and we mustn't forget that, ultimately, keep Sunday special is a means to an end rather than the end in itself. That we have to bear that in mind. Okay?